Kit Hogg, Penny Hogg, Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they?
At home with the Hoggs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Good day and welcome to the programme that is Talk Radio, Europe's Saturday magazine. Yes, you're at home with the Hogs. I'm Kit.
And I'm Pen. Good morning.
And we hope you can stay with us for at least two of the next 2 hours of compulsive conversation, sizzling stories and scintillating satire here on the programme that puts expats in the driving seat. Whatever that means.
Anyway,
on today's show, connecting with the heart of deeper Spain in Almagro, La Mancha, the story which is the second part of our Spanish road trip, which includes a tradition popular amongst Spaniards called gin tonic.
Gin tonic.
Matthew Bennett, consummate commentator on Spanish current affairs, on the new right in this country. Janie Jewson is back with us to ask our reaction to offers of help and why we often resist. And in just a moment, in the aftermath of Sunday's flood, Ali Mudge joins us from Cortes de la Frontera, because we can't really sit here and pretend that this hasn't been a week
of happened.
Exacting proportions for any number of us river dwellers here in Malaga province.
And exciting news, tomorrow morning, the clocks change.
Oh, do they?
Okay,
yeah. Yes. Okay, well, that's kind of good because it means the weekend is 1 hour longer.
1 hour longer. Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And what, every 6 months I have this conversation.
Yes, you're used to it now. What connotation does that have for getting up in the morning?
It's going to be lighter.
Yes,
it is.
It means we're not going to be blundering around like in the dark at 8:15.
No, we're not. Excellent. So, and I just saw this morning that Morocco's decided not to change their clocks.
Oh, how very contrary.
It is very contrary. So I shall look that up. But that's an interesting thing. If you happen to be catching a ferry to Tangier tomorrow morning, check it.
Right. So that means there'll be 2 hours difference or something.
Yeah,
Who knows? Anyway, we're not about to go to Tangiers. So there we are. The watery home of the Hogs, now full of mud. I have to tell you, the land devastated by a river that once sustained it. And so this is a bit of a theme of today's programme. It's a story of two valleys, the Genal and the Guadiaro. And I know you guys in El Padrón have had a dowsing as well. And you'll be asking yourself the question, just like we have, how do you stay upright when your world has been turned upside down? So in spite of the 4 a.m. wake-up calls in hemorrhaging grief and premonition of ruin, in spite of the... You've been doing it too, babes. In spite of the sucking post-flood mud that coats everything it touches like a contagion.
Even here, now.
Well, it's lovely and clean in here. The show...
We're not.
The show must go on.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know this score. On and on, does anybody know what we are looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime behind the curtain in the pantomime.
Freddie Mercury, where the show must go on, of course. Joining us from, by the way, Kenny, I can tell you're calling me. Can you call us back in the second hour, please? Very nice to hear from you, as ever. But we must press on. Joining us from up Campo, Cortes de la Frontera, in the heart of the remote borderland between Malaga and Cadiz provinces, is our first guest, Ali Marge. Ali, hi, good morning.
Good morning, Kate.
Right, very nice. Very nice to hear from you.
Good morning. How are you? Hi, lovey. Sorry. I shouldn't eat a health bars just before I'm about to speak.
I thought you were chewing your rescue remedy.
No, it's my rescue
chewing gum. Don't swallow.
No, I won't swallow. Hey, Ali, how is it in Cortes this morning and over this week? How have people? What happened on Sunday?
Yes, explain to us what happened first of all.
Well, it was incredibly sudden, as you yourselves know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a crazy amount of rain actually here, but it didn't last very long. It was about sort of 5-10 minutes of rain, but really the main rain was up near Campillos, and it was in about an hour. A massive wall of water came down between the Guadalevin and the Guadiaro rivers.
And Cortes, Estación Cortes is on which river?
On the Guadiaro.
On the Guadiaro.
The Guadialevin is the one that's going under the Puente Nuevo in Ronda.
Okay.
But they all joined together, and it was just completely devastating.
And so nobody was ready for this, obviously.
No, there was no time to get ready for this.
They
knew that there was some water coming, and... some people had begun to think that maybe there would be, that the river would flood, but nothing prepared anybody for what was coming at all.
And there were houses in Estación Cortes. Tell us, because a lot of us don't know Estación Cortes, but this place is, when it's on the riverside, it really is on the riverside, isn't it?
You walk out
the front door and look over the wall and look over a small retaining wall, and there is the river.
Exactly. It's a river community. It's right on the bank. It's a very poor community as well. So before I go today, I really want to make sure that I give you all the info for if anybody wants to donate and help, because everybody can in their way. People have lost everything.
Swept down the street, really, and filled everybody's bottom.
The river just completely burst its banks, went into the main street, was like a river, with cars and everything floating down it. But within minutes, we had 3 helicopters flying above.
Wow.
Trying to help people. They did save one local artist, Christine Spencer Green. She got airlifted out from her house.
That was quite dramatic, wasn't it? Because that footage appeared on YouTube or Facebook or somewhere. I saw that happening. Describe that scenario, Ali.
The river just came up so quickly. You know, it was within 5 minutes they were trapped. They could not get out.
Yeah. That's her and her husband and and the dog.
Exactly. There was a group of neighbours that had been trying to help them get out, who were helping other people along the riverbank.
Yeah.
So the helicopter was called. They were there. The Guardia Civil were amazing. There was one, he came down, hitched Christine's partner, who's infirm and can't walk properly at the moment. So he got taken up, lifted out first. And Christine put her dog in a canvas bag and climbed on and hugged this Guardia Civil for dear life.
From the roof. From the roof of their house.
From the roof of the house, you know, it was extraordinary. And all the emergency services have been incredible. It could have really been a lot worse.
I mean, alarmingly, in the footage, she's dangling underneath this helicopter, and the helicopter then just chunters off, you know.
Well, they couldn't get her in. They were trying to push her up into the helicopter, and they couldn't manage to do that.
That's sort of a bizarre fairground ride, you know. it's called Escape with Your Life.
Poor woman.
Really, really very dramatic and terrifying for them.
Okay, but she's all right now. And
yeah,
the dogs
how are they doing now?
Yeah, how are they
she's
doing?
She's fine, but the house is it's devastated.
Forgetting
the whole of the downstairs. There's been parts, because there's houses that are actually, you know, on the plains near the river that, again, everything is lost. We had a new family move in on Friday. And by Sunday morning, they'd lost everything that they'd turned up with.
This is
extraordinary. And a new family moved in on Friday, and like, welcome to Spain. They got
exactly,
blown away by the roof. Oh my God!
They've moved over to do Tai Chi retreats.
Uh-huh.
So they're being incredibly philosophical about the whole thing, but. All of their stuff had been unloaded on Friday afternoon, and on Sunday it was all taken away by the river. Quad bikes, all their personal effects and possessions.
And so they just arrived, it wouldn't have been insured or anything, would it?
Exactly. That is a bit of an issue. But there's been a real outpouring of just community spirit. Mm. Everyone has been incredible.
Mm.
Protección Civil have been helping out. Everyone's been helping each other clean out their silted-up houses.
But it's a very a pretty poor area because lack of employment, etc. So people now, their fridges and their cookers and their tellies, beds, blankets have all sort of been ruined. So after we finish talking to you, perhaps you could tell us how we can actually help people.
Yeah, and just in just a moment, let me ask you what the insurance situation is here. Are campesinos particularly insured? It's not part of the culture, is it, really?
It isn't. It isn't
and
part of the
money.
Culture. And also, it's an expense. I mean, if you've got a mortgage, then you have to be insured by law. But very often, if you don't, if you've got your family house that has been, your little family house that has been handed down, you won't have got insurance. But in total, I mean, there's the insurance committee has estimated there's about 34 million in damages for insurance claims. And the Serranía de Ronda, the town hall, is saying that there's been at least 3.5 million in damages. So there's a lot of people that have lost literally everything who really need some help. There has been a fund. The mayor did go to Malaga and ask for a relief fund.
Good.
Those people without insurance get 2,500 euros, which is a complaint, but no way is going to help them get fridges, beds, you know, everything that they've lost. Because there's a lot of one-story houses. You know, it's already a subsistence economy where we're at.
I mean, I wonder if there are people, here on the coasts, and I obviously apologies to people who are in Mallorca and Valencia, and it doesn't apply to you, but
well,
here
it does apply to people in Mallorca, doesn't it? Because they suffered
absolutely,
badly, and I believe that happened at night, which is why there were 12 fatalities. Mm. I mean, thank goodness what happened last Sunday happened during the day.
Absolutely. But what I meant by that was if you've got a fridge that's old but works, or a cooker that's old that works, or beds, or quite often people upgrade their flats, don't they, and their letting houses, anything like that, would that be welcome?
That would be very welcome. The best thing to do would be to either contact the town halls in each of the affected areas, or the one near you, I suppose, or Protección Civil. Protección Civil have been working round the clock with organisations like Infoca and stuff to either get things to people or...
But Ali, say tomorrow people want to just get in their cars and come and give stuff, because I think a lot of us or a lot of people don't necessarily speak Spanish. We can get the number if you just want to fill your car up with stuff and drove to Cortes de la Frontera. How would that be possible? I mean, just...
It is possible to get to us, and I would find the town hall or the church. The church of... there's an organisation attached to the church called Caritas who have also been doing...
Okay, so head for the church and donate there.
Or the town hall.
Or the town hall. Okay, I'm just writing this down.
No, that's great. So Caritas, yeah?
Caritas, yeah.
Right. Right.
They've been doing a lot of work for people.
Oh,
and then if you can't come up and hand over help with goods, then there's a Facebook page, the town hall, the Cortes de la Frontera town hall Facebook page has put up the bank account information for any cash donations. And there's a lot of people in dire need.
Okay.
Ali, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ali. Thank you very much.
And good luck to everybody in the Guadiana Valley.
Yeah, and well done, Christine. She never... Yeah. Funny how life turns out.
We were going to try and talk to Christine.
Well, the other thing, if you can talk to Christine, that'd be great. I mean, she's a painter, and obviously, you know, she needs help. So any...
Anybody wants a painting?
Yes. Yeah, bye.
Ali, thank you so much.
Lots of love and good luck with you two too, okay?
Thank you.
Bye now. Bye.
That's Ali Majin, Cortes de la Frontera. Coming up after the break, the second part of our Spanish road trip.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Last week I told you how instead of going to Nepal with my brother, I took a long weekend to the edge of Don Quixote country. There in the Spanish heartlands of La Mancha is a jewel of a town with a glorious colonnaded 17th century plaza. Here's Dutch historian Cees Notenboom. That evening, we reach Almagro, one of those Spanish wonders the sunseekers of Benidorm have never heard of. White, still enigmatic, a memory of lost greatness. The Plaza Mayor is rectangular here, a large living room with glassed-in verandas like walls. Here, there is nothing for the imagination to do. One is drawn into ancient times without resistance. This was the headquarters of the Order of Calatrava, the oldest in Spain, founded by Cistercian monks in 1158 to drive out the Moors. Initially, they wore monk's garb. Later, they took to wearing a white cloak with a cross of red lilies. In the twilight, you think you can see them flitting about the narrow streets. Everywhere you look, there are buildings emblazoned with the arms of extinct families, lions, crowns, quarterings, banners, hints of courtly loves and battles, power and transience. When dusk has fallen, I take a stroll around the square, but I do not see it properly till the next day. In the torpor of that afternoon, men doze on park benches. The flag above the town hall hangs limp. I read the poem on the statue of Diego de Almagro, the captain general of the Kingdom of Chile, who died in Cusco without setting eyes on his birthplace in Almagro again. He does not resemble Don Quixote, this knight on his steed. He charged not at windmills, but against Amerindians. And perhaps that's why the world, save for Almagro, has forgotten him. I visit the churches and the wonderful little playhouse with its roof of open sky and wonder what it was like to observe the stage from one of the boxes with a flickering oil lamp by your side, and to hear the words of Lope de Vega and Calderón de la Barca under the moon and stars. Well, I too headed into the town of Almagro at dusk, scheduled in the secluded, in the comforting envelope of anonymity. That of being an unknown in the unknown. In spite of the cultural splendour through which I was passing, two places that had their origins very much later than the 17th century caught my attention. The first, opposite but unhumbled by the neighbouring basilica called La Madre de Dios, was a hair replacement clinic. Centro Médico Capilar Salvidar. Now, I took this to be some sort of sign. It was an undeniable portent that here, in the very hem of the Mother of God herself, was the potential cure to my alopecia that, 10 days earlier, had manifest itself pocking my beard in a 50-centimo-sized patch of baldness on the tip of my chin. An obsession that had since forced me to shave off my face's saving grace. It was Friday night and the Centro Médico Capilar Salvador was, unsurprisingly, closed. But there was a phone number on the surgery window which I called immediately. The welcoming woman I spoke to left me in no doubt that Dr. Francisco Salvidar was some sort of luminary in hair replacement. Indeed, he was operating in Sevilla no less that very day, and for sure he'd be able to help with the patch of missing growth that had ridiculed my pretense of a beard. She would speak to him on my behalf in the morning. The second place that captured my attention was on the wall opposite another church, La Iglesia de San Agustín, one that I was thinking I might visit, but the sign was a distraction. It hung next to the leafy entrance of a patio bar opposite, and it quite simply said, "Lo mejor gin tonic de tu vida." It had been a long day. I'd visit San Agustín tomorrow. Now, gin tonic has forced its way into Spanish culture. We sort of thought it was a British thing, but tell us a bit about gin tonic and the Spanish tradition of drinking it, babe.
Well, not invented, just perfected. Gin and tonic may have been born in India in the 19th century, but gin tonic is a uniquely Spanish culture, one that began to take shape in the early 2000s in corners of Madrid and Barcelona. Now it's common to find even dive bars selling dozens of customised creations. What is a dive bar?
I don't know what a dive bar is. I'm assuming it's a bit of
a
dive.
Joint, yeah. Yeah. Just wondering, you know, with lots of divers in their flippers. Anyway, size matters.
My snorkel's in the way.
Size matters. No highball or rock glasses. A Spanish gin tonic must be made in a big-bellied wine glass like the ones used for powerful reds. Same goes for the ice. Normal ice means instant dilution. Good bars serve 2 to 3 massive cubes that will hold the cold. Bars stock up to 50 gins, half a dozen tonics, and an arsenal of garnishes, citrus peel, fresh herbs, thyme, rosemary and basil, whole spices, peppercorns, juniper, and fresh produce. Good Lord. Cucumber, ginger and chilli. You want harmony between gin, tonic and garnish. To drink it like a Spaniard, you don't drink gin and tonic for any other hard liquor before a meal. Well, that's us out of the question then. Just one of these on an empty stomach will get you going. And gin tonics are most commonly consumed as a digestivo after a big meal or at the bar in the early morning hours.
So slightly hungover after my gin tonic, the next morning I was heartened to have received a WhatsApp message from hair recovery expert Dr. Francisco Salvidar himself, petitioning a photograph of my chin. Really? How exposing. This I would do later when the light was right. It was too early for selfies. I'm not in the habit of taking selfies, anyway.
You've never done one in your life except by mistake.
That's right. This would be my first intentional selfie.
Oh, God.
So in the breaking gold of another La Mancha sunrise, I walked to the plaza for coffee. The magisterial cobbled ramblers that are the treeless streets of Almagro are an architectural precision and are actually immaculately clean. Their precision is not only due to their width being in perfect proportion to the height of the two-story terraces of the Casa Señorales that border them, but this perfect balance between the horizontal and the vertical is accentuated by a definition unbroken by trees. Their cleanliness, too, correct rather than surgical. No irregularity of leaf litter or old oranges plopping onto pavements. And how atmospheric the names of these streets. Calle Federico Relimpio, Calle Obispo Babardo, Panuelas de San Juan, Corredera de Calatrava, Calle Padre Benito Doctor. Each one a life, each one a story. It's something you can't do in Morocco, for example, visit the mosque. You can admire it from outside, you can sense its allure, but as a non-believer, you can't wander in. As you can a cathedral here in Spain. And it's something that I, as a non-believer, do invariably when soaking up an impression of a pueblo or a city by brushing with the living history of shrines, altars, and footstep-worn paving, endeavouring inexpertly to distinguish the Gothic from the Renaissance, or the Romanesque, the Mudéjar from the Morisco, enjoying the play of light and dark through stained glass, the Catholic paradigm of salvation and suffering, which inevitably saturates the building and sometimes being touched by the hush of stillness. But which church do you recommend that I visit? I asked the woman in the pastelería as she wrapped a torta de almendra in a parcel of paper and string. San Bartolomé, she said, without hesitation. But try to enter La Iglesia San Bartolomé in Almagro that Saturday evening. It was a bit like wading against the tide of people who were pressing to leave. Not in a panicky bomb scare way, more an exodus flow that follows the end of a performance. And indeed, there had been a performance of sorts. Incongruously, to my mind, for a Saturday night, there'd been a misa, or a mass, an hour previously. Once through the door, I was immediately nonplussed by the disarming ostentation of the interior, an auditorium of Baroque, white and gold, wedding cake style. How can the gaunt, barn-like, unpretentious massif of the exterior harbour so much bling? My stock reaction in this circumstance is a cursory, hands clasped behind the back, Prince Charles-style circuit of the premises before heading for the door. On this occasion, however, I remained standing in the aisle. There was something in the air. In spite of those who were leaving as I had arrived, the place was half full of people of all ages, standing in groups of family and friends, chatting and greeting in relaxed animation that filled the nave with a warm, burbling backdrop of conversation and soft laughter at almost restaurant volume. Certainly several notches up from the hushed levels I associate with being in church. There was nothing irreverent about the handshakes, hugs and kisses that surrounded me with a happiness nothing short of infectious. An usher of some description was holding court with a small group just the other side of a pillar from me, and I asked him if there were normally this number of people in San Bartolomé on a Saturday night. A veces sí, a veces no, he said. And when I remarked that this convivial temple was quite unlike anything you might find in England at this or at any other time, he laughed, nodded and confided, yes, at times it does get a little bit loud. And then, with forgiving indulgence, he said, pero usted sabe cómo son los españoles. The church I visited the next morning was, for different reasons, equally uplifting. For there, in La Iglesia de Calatrava la Nueva, I was completely alone. Nueva? Not really. It was built in the 8th century and stands on top of a 1,000-metre-high extinct volcano which broods over a crucial pass linking the Guadalquivir with the Meseta. The church was the chapel of the warrior Cistercian monks who, having contributed to the rout of the Almohad Moors on the 16th of July 2012 in the epic game-changing battle of Navas de Tolosa, established themselves in the impregnable castle of Calatrava, in which the church is now cosseted. Today, it's silent in its deconsecration, rough furnished with pews and battle standards, a gorgeous, glassless, 4-metre diameter rose-shaped window, El Rosetón, beckoning the sky from the west end, through which the wind murmurs as once again I stood in a church, now under pillars and arches of volcanic rock, spans of frozen lava, the colour of dried blood. Stepping outside, I made my way up wind-whipped stone staircases to the highest battlement of the Castillo de Calatrava, to gorge on the oceanic expanse of rolling gold hills and forests folding south towards Despeñaperros and the beginnings of Andalusia. It was an appropriate moment to take a selfie of my alopecia chin and send it to Dr. Francisco Salvedar.
At home with the Hogs.
Welcome back. It's been a long time, but he is back. We're delighted to welcome our indefatigable home correspondent, authoritative and informed raconteur on all Spanish current affairs, Matthew Bennett from the Patreon platform. He joins us now from Murcia. Matthew, very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Kit and Penny.
Penn's popped out for the moment, but she will be back. I've proclaimed in the London Times this week. First of all, before I want to open this conversation, Matthew, with two figures from opposite ends of the Spanish political spectrum. Let's go right, first of all, because proclaimed in the London Times this week was a headline: far right set to win Spanish seats, first Spanish seats for decade. Who or what is Vox?
Okay, so Vox is a party that was set up by a former Popular Party MP called Santiago Abascal a few years ago, not many years ago, a few years ago. And it has adopted this alt-right, far-right position as regards the Spanish political spectrum. In the elections in 2015 and 2016, didn't get very many votes at all, fewer than 50,000. But it has learned a little bit to have some sort of media impact. So it gets some stories in the papers and on the news sometimes. And it's very good at using lawsuits to make its political points.
For example,
it has acted as a political party, a minority political party, so still zero seats in Parliament. It's got a few councillors in different places around the country, but still no MPs in Parliament, no MEPs in Brussels. But for example, it's been acting as a private prosecution in a lot of the lawsuits and criminal complaints that have happened over the Catalan separatist affair. So the Spanish legal system allows for that kind of thing, and an organisation or an association or a company can act as a private prosecution.
Right, this is one of their things, isn't it? They're rigidly anti-independista.
Yes, they are very anti-separatist and very pro-Spanish unity, as are Ciudadanos and the PP. It's a right-wing position generally in Spain.
Mm-hmm. And I read that their poll, which was at 3.5%, their approval rating at 3.5% back in June, now stands at 15.6, which is pretty
15.6.
Much... 15.6? Yeah, pretty much of a quantum leap.
I haven't seen 15.6.
It's repeated. This is a report from Graham Keely in Madrid.
Right.
Gaining popularity.
The ones I've seen have been between, depending on the poll, have been between 1.5% and 5%, which is a big leap anyway, and would be enough to give them perhaps 2 or 3 seats in Parliament, depending on where the votes came from around the country.
So a trend without being hugely significant.
It could be a trend. So They're a very small party coming from those very small national figures. And the problem with Spain is, or the Spanish electoral system is, for a national party to try to get lots of votes, because it's split up into different provincial constituencies, those smaller parties, like the Catalan nationalists or the Basque nationalists, who concentrate all of their efforts in one region, do better with the same number of votes than a small party that tries to get that same number of votes but across the country.
Mm. Now, you describe the party as extreme right, but Mr. Abascal told the London Times last week, "The media call us far right, but the situation is more complicated."
Let him finish.
Vox will be a party that does not fit. It is liberal, conservative, traditional. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I would basically agree with Abascal. So I would say it is described as extreme right or ultra right or far right. I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, he certainly doesn't, does he?
I agree with that quote. I haven't seen the whole interview with him, but I would agree with that quote. It's more complex if you look at the policies and things. We're not talking about Hitler here.
Or indeed a Falange.
No.
I think, you know, we have to guard those of us of liberal disposition, and I wonder if I am at the moment, but anyway, do you think so, babes? I don't know. Anyway, important. But what I do get the feeling is that the media is prone to hysteria at the expression of Europeans who question the assumption that we should open the doors to our continent. And that seems to me a question that is worth asking, and one that he is asking.
Right. So if we look at some of the, they published a document in September which has got 100 policy ideas in it, right? These things that political parties do that almost nobody pays much attention to, and two or three of them get into the news. Mm-hmm. So if we look at two or three different policy areas, yes, they're very strong on Spanish national identity because of the Catalan crisis, as are the other two parties on the right. Yes, they have very strong ideas on immigration and the control of borders, but they say that they're not against immigration per se, they just want to control immigration, like what might happen in, say, Australia or Canada or somewhere like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at their position on Europe, like the other Spanish political parties, they're not Eurosceptic. They want to change a couple of things, the way the relationship exists with Europe, but they're not talking about coming out of Europe. So if we look at the positions on some of those things, if you're already on the left, or the extreme left, if we want to go that way too, then yes, some of the policies that Abascal and Vox have will look to you like they're extreme right or ultra-right. Perhaps, there's this label alt-right, isn't there, which has come from America over the last couple of years since
Trump. Yeah, what does Trump. Alt stand
yes,
for?
Yes, what is alt short for?
Sorry?
Is it alternative? What is
alternative? Alternative right.
Alternative right.
Mm-hmm. This idea, this label that they started to use in America, basically to describe Trump supporters who weren't traditional Republican Party voters, perhaps, but this way, and then depending on the news outlet, they've used alt-right, or they described it as extreme right, or racist, or xenophobic. It's all a bit confusing, isn't it, with the labels and the different ideas that people have.
Okay, well, sorry,
no, I'm glad you're confused, Mike, because then I there's really no point in me even trying.
Penny, perpetually confused.
Perpetually perplexed.
Okay, so let's leave Mr. Abascal now.
Because I know you're interested in this, Kit, but so one thing, a couple of weeks ago, they held a meeting, a political rally in Madrid. And they got 10,000 people to fill it, and apparently there were 3,000 people outside, okay? And the significance of this is, within the party's small but relevant rise in the poll numbers at the minute, is that the place that they filled with the rally was the same place that Podemos filled with its rally back in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back when nobody really knew what Podemos was, the alternative left, if you like, Podemos filled this place in Madrid with its own political rally. So Vox just did the same, but on the alternative right.
Mm. Yeah, Yep. Okay. Okay. So, watch that. Watch this space. I must apologise to you, Matthew. I misread the stat I gave you earlier on their approval rating. Is in fact 5.1. I was mistaking that for the 15.6% was a rating for people who are concerned about immigration. Let's leave Mr. Abascal now. He's apparently married to Lydia Bedman, a YouTube personality. They have 4 children. His family was once threatened by ETA, the Basque separatist organization, and he holds a license to carry a Smith & Wesson pistol. At the other end of the political spectrum, Andalusia's socialist leader, Susana Diaz, who has those pleasantly cow-like eyes. I kind of like looking at her. She's been making the rounds.
Funny of, that, isn't it?
Cow, yeah, yes. Like sort of big lashes and, you
oh
know.
My God.
And kind of bovine sweetness, you know. And she's been making the rounds of, hey, not getting jealous. She's been making the rounds of Malaga's flood-stricken vecinos.
Is she on her way to us?
Well, I wonder. Yeah.
That would be insane.
Venga, Susana, vamos. How seriously, actually, though, do we take the speculation that she has ambitions to become a national figure within PSOE and potentially Spain's first lady president?
Well, she has had over the past few years. She was the arch rival. She still is the arch rival, despite the smiley photos of the two that came out from the meeting yesterday. She still is the arch rival of Pedro Sanchez within the Socialist Party. And a couple of years ago, when they ousted Pedro Sanchez, she was behind the ousting. And then he managed to fight his way back and become the leader again with grassroots socialist support. So
no love lost between those two, then?
No.
Right, and with Sanchez without a majority, scrabbling about to pass his budget. I mean, you told me earlier this week that he'd actually been to jail to try and forge a link with the separatists.
Pablo Iglesias went to jail. But the socialist government has got the budget it has to present. Podemos is going to support the socialist party with its budget, but the prime minister himself can't go to jail to negotiate. So Pablo Iglesias went last week to have a quiet word on his behalf.
Now, we rarely mention Brexit on this programme. I mean, it's a policy, actually, not to mention Brexit. But you've got some news on a Spanish reaction to Brexit.
Well, a British-Spanish reaction. Yesterday on my own little podcast, I talked to Chris Doty, who's the president of the British Chamber of Commerce in Spain. He represents about 300 companies in Spain that are responsible for about 200,000 jobs in Spain, directly and indirectly. And he says those companies and British companies generally in Spain pay about 6 billion euros in tax to the Spanish exchequer every year.
Wow.
And that because of Brexit, of course, all of that is in some way at risk. Because not like we know on a personal level, we've had no guidance about the options for nationality or visas or whatever it is that's supposed to happen after Brexit, and whatever type of Brexit it ends up being, companies, British companies in Spain are in exactly the same situation. So they don't know if Brexit is really going to happen on March 29th, what kind of Brexit it will be, or what they have to do to prepare for it either.
Outrageous.
So bad news for them, bad news potentially for the Spanish government, because 6 billion euros is a lot of dosh.
Yeah, and that's before we start talking about tourism flights. So an international aviation organisation put out a report this week on Brexit, talking about the possibility of a no-deal hard Brexit, and said that 95% of the flights between Spain and the UK, I suppose in both directions, are at risk if there's a hard Brexit, because in the aviation industry, no preparation has been done to prepare companies for what's supposed to happen next. So between the two different stories, Brexit Spain stories this week, the summary is nobody has a clue what's about to happen with Brexit. Mm. And all of that business and all of those lives and all of those statuses are at stake now. And the deadline is getting very, very close.
Yes, it is. It's quite exciting, really, isn't it? I mean, because we're about to witness a bit. It's not unlike the year 2000 when planes were about to drop out of the sky with the whole computer
yeah.
thing. But
the millennium bug that never happened.
Yeah, yeah. But this actually one feels is more real. Is actually really a cliff.
This was a damp squib in the end.
Yes, it was.
This is going to be more real. For sure.
That was like a conspiracy. Matthew, we just got time to go back, retrace our steps. The Catalonia Podemos Republic, I've got written here. What is that?
How long have we got?
We've got 3 minutes.
Oh, 3 minutes. Okay, let's try. It's the first anniversary today of the Declaration of Independence that took place in Catalonia last year. And there was a Declaration of Independence. The judges are quite clear on that now, despite what some separatists and some people in the Spanish government or Spanish politicians have tried to argue that it wasn't really a declaration of independence, it was just a kind of show. Important point is, they're not really, even the separatists are not really celebrating it or commemorating it today on the first anniversary. Why not? Probably because the declaration of independence, a declaration of independence, is an important part of the crime of rebellion, which is why the separatist prisoners are in jail on remand. So if they want to try to get rebellion knocked down to sedition or the misuse of public funds or some lesser relative charge, then they wouldn't want to be shouting about the fact that there was actually a declaration of independence and that they did it.
Right. Is that position not overly pliant and rather submissive?
In what sense?
In the sense that they're not really serious about independence and they're kowtowing to Madrid.
Right, their stated objective, public objective has changed, hasn't it, over the past year from independence from Spain to getting the prisoners out of jail.
Right.
And getting the case thrown out of court.
Mm-hmm.
But they were never, if we think about it in realistic terms, in the way the real world works, Kit, they were never serious about it. They didn't even take, when they declared independence last year, it was a Friday, I think, wasn't it? They didn't even take down the Spanish flag on Catalan government HQ.
Right.
Not even a symbolic gesture. Mm-hmm. And then by Monday, Puigdemont was in Brussels.
Yes.
Right at the end of it.
Had fled. Yeah.
Exactly.
Matthew, it's been great talking to you. Tell us how we can hear you more on the Patreon on the Patreon platform. Yeah.
Yeah, you can. You
tell
can
us about
find
that.
Me, about the Patreon. Well, it's a platform where you can find me.
Well, you on the Patreon.
And listen to me.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, we want to hear more of what you have to say on Patreon about Spanish political affairs.
Great. So come and read. Everybody can come along and read.
And what do you put in Patreon, yeah?
On Google. Yeah, yes. Type in Matthew Bennett Patreon, I suppose, in Google, and you'll find me. Or come and find me via the Twitter account.
Okay, brilliant, man. Thank you so much, as ever. We'll speak soon, yeah?
Thank you, Kit and Penny. Best of luck.
Come and stay.
Have the most excellent weekend. Coming up after the news, we have, well, stories of the flood. And welcome back. Now, if you're in the Estepona zone, could I take this opportunity to recommend a gig? The fabled rock band Equis play tomorrow, Sunday, from 4:30 at Pepe's Chiringuito Bar, Beachside Sabanillas, where the life of rock promoter Jeff Turner from Ringo's Bar, Duquesa, will be honoured and his ashes are going to be spread in the sea. So that will be an auspicious and rather lovely occasion if you're in the western Costa del Sol. In stark contrast to the seductive tones of the bouquet scent of a brand new car, tints of velour, hints of Drelon, and the musky aroma of the leather gear fob, nothing prepares you for the very same smell of that car, or the smell of the very same car, just 6 weeks later, once it has been inundated, bobbing in a flood of brown river water, tethered to an orange tree to prevent it rolling away seawards, shipping volumes of flood sludge into an interior that might be airtight, but is nevertheless prone to seepage of water laced with a perniciously penetrative gloop of silt. A gunk that now coats the cabin in the aftermath of this most recent of Mother Nature's surprises. As you prise open the door of your brand new car, you're overcome by two sensations, at the futility and waste of it all, the sadness. And isn't there a poignancy about mud-covered technology? iPod and phone, now pond life in the central console. Remote key fob slimed and lifeless. Keys clagged on the driver's seat, which is now sodden, coated in mud. The sat-nav Bluetooth info touchscreen, once singing and dancing, twinkling in blue and silver digital neons with enough info and data to plan your day, or with a deft caress to give you radio, Spotify or CD. Now a lifeless corpse, clouded, like a forever blind eye. The alarms, bells and buzzers silent now as you jam the key into the grit-encrusted ignition. You twist it in the forlorn hope that the engine will spark into life like an obedient sewing machine. Didn't Clarkson detonate a 25-storey building over a Toyota Hilux to recover it from the rubble and then start it again on Top Gear? Rubble is at least dry, but this Hilux had drowned, blinking its SOS in its last pathetic gasps with a flashing indicator. But it's that smell of the interior as it sweats in slime at the very initial fermentation of decay, a combination of the synthetic and the organic, not unlike cheap air freshener sprayed around a recently used laboratory. Get a whiff of this putrid stench and have no doubt. The pretentious close-the-door intimacy of the cosseting car womb has been violated by Mother Nature. Because there's a refrain in our valley. El río lleva lo suyo. The river takes its own. And last Sunday, it took a whole lot more than a pickup truck. It was around midday Sunday last, 21st of October, anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar, if I'm not mistaken, that Penn and I stood on the banks of the River Hennal, some 75 metres from our house, and watched the water from a rock promontory, a great little mirador which we used to spy a river in spate, chunks of tree, canyon, and the odd gas bonbonner bobbing their way to the estuary. It was raining on and off, nothing untoward, apart from the shattering peals of thunder that suggested, actually, it should be wetter. We'd been flooded before, 9 years ago on Christmas Eve, after 3 days of continual rain. And then the water had crept into the finca and up the lawn and into the downstairs bathroom over a period of several hours. No way had it rained like that then. It wasn't happening on Sunday. We were going to be fine. Hey, we need the rain. Yeah, I might go up to the Pueblo and get a Sunday paper this afternoon. An hour later, I was in the workshop on the other side of the house from the river when I heard Penn shouting. It was more of a bark than a shout, a tone of voice that, after years of living together, triggers a synapse for an instant and incisive response. What did you say, babe?
Get the top.
Yeah, she said it a bit more barkingly than that. As I left the workshop with the tarpaulin, a table-high wall of rust-coloured water was locomoting its way around the south side of the house. By the time I delivered Penn the top, a journey of some 20 metres, the wave had broken onto the patio terrace by the front door. Next thing that happened was, as I came down the front step, to my left, the log pile exploded like a burst dam. It was the weight of water that had accumulated on the north side of the house. Now knee-deep in flotsam of chopped firewood, I waded back into the yard where both cars were parked. Penn's Lexus, I could only move about 2 metres up a shallow bank. Getting out, water flooded in. Managed to bang the door shut, and within moments, waist-deep, I hoiked a length of rope from the workshop and tethered the aforesaid Toyota pickup to an orange tree. I was up to my chest, the Toyo floating. Swimming back to the house through the jetsam of gas bottles, paint pots, dog bowls and logs, I forced entry into the flooding kitchen and upstairs to join Penn and the two dogs. With the water rising inside and outside the house and alarmingly up through the bowl of the lavatory in the bathroom, it behoved us to consider a plan of escape. Bagging passports and cash stash in polythene, we stood on the upstairs terrace, which the bedroom opens onto, and surveyed the scene. Our green and pleasant land, 3 hectares of meadow, orchard and garden, was now part of the river. The house was completely surrounded by the rising swell. The main flow of water was some 50 metres to the south of us, where the torrent was cutting a diagonal across the heart of the finca, bypassing the curve of its natural course. Here, it had risen into a ripping column several stories high above the flight, in a longitudinal wave, as Penn said last night, was like a block of flats, with the speed of a train, an anaconda debris of spume and wave. One by one, with indifferent violence, it felled the poplars that graced the original bank. 25-metre trees keeling over like 9 pins in front of a firing squad, then to become absorbed in the morass and fury of the monster. Spellbound by the destruction of a place that had morphed from a riverside paradise very suddenly into a ghastly spectacular, and with no longer much option for lingering, our plan was to jump from the terrace into the swill and scramble to the bank, into which the house nestles some 3 metres distant, dragging the two dogs with us. Doable as this was, it would have left us bedraggled, cold and walking. We sat in a huddle on the bed, duveted, teeth chattering with chill and adrenaline, popping out to the terrace at intervals to marvel and curse our river. Our lifeblood turned assassin. And then down in what used to be the garden, the washing line became visible, we noticed, bizarrely, because it was in a backwash and not the current. It had still had a pair of my underpants pegged, flapping, a sodden flag of defiance and an indication that the rage was easing. Then the sun shone, a baleful glare to illuminate the scene. Green bee-eaters whooped and careened above the gradually receding swell. Gobsmacked by the surprising events of this unusual Sunday, two things were becoming clear. One, life at home had become unsustainable. Two, we weren't going to jump off the roof. We'd leave by the front door. Except that it wouldn't open. I waded downstairs into the polluted lake that used to be the kitchen, punting the floating fridge out of the way. The weight of water and silt inside had seized the door. Oh dear. I sump-dived to the wine rack and surfaced with a bottle of scotch. At which point, we heard voices, eh?
Yeah, and before that, we had, thanks to our neighbours, Paul and Dawn, who just were having a pretty traumatic time themselves. We couldn't communicate or call with anybody because there was no signal. And they just saw this wall of water and knew our house was there and had got helicopter people over. And before we knew
they'd made the call, yeah?
I think they had, yes, or somebody had. And the bizarre feeling on a Sunday afternoon, we had decided then that we didn't have to jump, to have this helicopter literally dangling above your house where this man ready to send down a winch, and you trying to do. So how do you say, actually, we're fine, get back upstream, which they did. And so they knew all right. And so they followed the river upwards to our neighbours and then our neighbours after that. And miraculously, nobody needed to be rescued because we were able to get to higher ground.
Well, except we were rescued, weren't we? Because we were trapped inside the house.
And then suddenly there was a knock on the door. A knock on the door, like, hello? And it was Juanito. Juanito.
Yeah, well, I could hear him shouting.
We said, Cristóbal!
Yeah.
And this family of gitanos who we've known for years, and our dear, dear friend Callum appeared at the back door, front door.
Yeah, and they literally had to run down the mountain.
They'd run down from the top.
Because the road was fractured with the sheer width of water.
They'd run to the door, and there they were. It was absolutely great. They carried us out. It was superb, absolutely fantastic. And it's a strange thing, you know, to be up to your waist in water with your Birkenstocks on, like having to go up the mountain, being sort of carried by these gorgeous, gorgeous men. Yeah, it was quite phenomenal. And yet the dog's not wanting to leave the house. Well, what's next, guys? It was amazing, absolutely amazing. We did it. And thank you.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they? Yes, welcome back. Normally at this time we have arbalistas, trees, palms and gardens, but we're not going to this week because we're doing a flood special. But we would like to say that in spite of the fact that all our machinery received a serious drowsing, we're going to give big thanks to Los de Mata here in Guadalmina, who have stripped, cleaned and restarted all our
chainsaws.
Yeah, trimmer and desbrozadora. Fumigator. So, arbalista in business.
That's, certainly in business.
Yep.
Keep calling.
We need you. We need your business. Yeah, that's all we're going to be saying about that. Janie Jewson has joined us. Janie, hi.
Good morning. How are you?
Nice to have you. I know some of you have been trying to get through, Kenny, Janet particularly. So the lines are now open. So if you want to join us vocally.
Can I just say, I just spoke to Kenny.
952-784-000. Yes, babe.
Sorry to interrupt. Just spoke to Kenny. Thanks so much for the call, guys. And take care of yourselves as well. And we'll talk to you very, very soon.
Okay. We do have Janet on the line right now. Hi, Janet. Good morning to you.
Hi. It's just turned from day till night in Mallorca. It's pouring down with rain and it's ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum.
Really?
Oh, what fun. Wow.
Right.
Really?
So, really, a big thunderstorm, yeah, and it's pouring down right in Palma.
So,
yeah. So
more danger of flooding, are you saying?
No. I live in a third floor flat. Thank you very much. It's one of the very few times I'm happy to live in a flat.
Yeah.
Especially when you described everything. I think, I don't know what I would have done, to be quite honest with you. I think you just, you know, how you react in that moment. Oh, goodness me.
I'll tell you what, Janet, it's called adrenaline. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Keeps you going for days. I'm still on it, and it could be another few weeks. You run out of that, you...
Yeah, the effort. It's wildly adrenalised. It's worrying. She will implode quite soon.
Tell me.
By the way, Penny,
yes?
I thank you. There was something you said that it was just struck me. I didn't know how to explain myself.
Yeah.
And you said it, perpetually perplexed.
Oh, that's the one.
And that
is
exactly how I feel.
I'm not going to ask you how old you are, so let's leave it at that, shall we?
No, I'm quite proud to be 65.
Oh, nearly twins.
Right. Well, we must get you two together. Well, maybe not, actually.
Oh, yes, dear.
Janet, well,
enjoy the rain.
Enjoy the rain, yeah, from your
thank
third
floor. Thank you. It's the thunder as well. I don't know if you can hear it. It's extremely loud.
No.
Anyway,
you'll be cut off any minute.
I'll tell you what, the thunder this October has been louder, more aggressive, more artillery-like than any thunder I've ever heard. Is this to do with global warming? Well, you know,
Who knows? But you've always had thunderstorms in
the West. No, that is massive thunder. Really, yeah. Really, quite freaky thunder.
Yes, it rattles the windows and all sorts of things, yeah.
It's actually woken me up out of my sleep. You know, It's that loud. It's like a just massive bomb going off sometimes.
It's the beginning of the war sort of thing, you know.
Yeah. And continuous.
Yes, it is. And it's not a boom, boom. It's boom, 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 boom. It goes on for a long time, you know. And you think, wait a minute, is that really thunder?
It sort of cascades into a huge explosion, doesn't it?
It's
incredible.
Anyway, take care of yourselves and hope everything gets back to normal soon.
It will. Mm. All right, Janet, thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Janet.
Bye-bye.
Normal, I remember that.
You were bored anyway. Can I just say one more thing?
You can, my love.
David, thanks for your call. David called from Fuengirola, and he's trying to get in touch with Ali about doing a donation from the Age Concern charity shop there. So if you didn't get through, David, give us another call just after midday, after one, and I'll get that sorted. All right, sorry.
Jenny.
Yes, I'm really fascinated by all of this business to do with how we respond to events in our lives. And in particular, on this instance, it's incredible how the community can respond to something that's widely known, like a natural disaster like this, like floods, like earthquakes, like, you know, major fires. People rally together and they come and they offer help in a way that if it was an individual potentially in a house on their own and something happened to them privately, personally, there is less of a calling. But when it's a lot of people and we all know about it, hits the news, everybody gets out there and they are right there for people. Now, Kit and Penny, has this happened for you in this situation? Has there been any help coming to you? I mean, I'm just making an assumption.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And a million percent.
Overwhelming. But, I mean, I think I was saying to Penn last night how overwhelmed. Yeah, we're overwhelmed by offers of goodwill. I mean, we arrived back last night and we found a hamper of food outside the house.
Wow.
We had people delivering meals. I mean, we could be name checking, but it's
we're not going
it's slightly in house, and we're on the radio, so we're not going to. I suffice it to say that I feel 6 days after this event very much more connected with people, very much a danger that we were living 4 kilometres up a dirt track.
We're not anymore.
And 2 people we will mention are Jay and Karen, our dear friends, who have lent us their beautiful house.
Amazing.
And land within within a stone's throw of where we lived. We couldn't have worked out better. Living where we live, there's a real danger that we become isolated, and it's easy to be reclusive when you live tucked away.
Exactly.
And this is like strip that away, and we're now open.
And
have been super supported.
Exactly. And who do you call on? You know, say you were, you know, your family have left, you don't have many relatives left. And you are sitting in this house and this disaster all around.
Just waving at Dave Hodgson, who's come into the studio, or he says he's next door through the glass. Yeah, very nice to see you. Yeah, come in.
Children.
Oh, we have children. Liz is really at home with the Hogs. And they're coming in.
Dave, hi, man.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. We're totally honoured here. Dave Hodgson.
Hello, Dave.
Hello.
From the Daily has arrived to be with us here at home with the Hogs. Dave, hi.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Sorry to interrupt your great radio show, but I wanted to come in and say on behalf of all the daytime staff at TRE, that we're with you at the moment, and we're sorry to hear.
Don't start us off, Dave. We'll stop loving.
We were all shocked to hear it, and you know, we all feel so helpless. I think is the other thing as well.
You feel helpless.
Yeah. it's great to have you back on the radio today.
We're very glad to be here.
I was going to ring in, but then I decided to bring the kid because I'm daddy daycare today. I've got my friend's children, my other daughter's at Amazonia. You know,
which
the
one of these little gorgeous ones
and this
are
one's
yours?
Mine. That's George. He's
hi, George.
Three.
Say hello.
He's 3 years old. Do you want to say hello on the radio? Yeah. Want to say hello?
Okay.
Hello.
Oh,
hey, George.
So. So I just wanted to pop in and wish you guys all the very best
thank
in the future.
You.
So,
thank you.
And the love your show, you know that.
We
so.
Really appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah. David, actually what we're talking about is accepting help. Yeah. And why we're sometimes reluctant to accept help. I mean, my normal reaction to accepting help is basically to shut down and say, yeah. no, I'm fine, we'll soldier on.
I think naturally...
This has been impossible yeah, in this
well,
situation.
Well, you can't, can you? But I think naturally as men, we try and fix every situation. We're built like that to kind of, you know, we can sort it out. We'll look after our own family. And we go inward. And obviously, from my position as a minister, I'm always telling people to pray and to ask for help. From God, but also from each other as well. And I think that's sometimes the last resort. You know, we think we can cope on our own and we'll be all right. You know?
I think we have to look to our own needs but and actually recognise them and say, well, you know, where is this help I need?
Yeah.
Because I do deserve. I actually do deserve. We're not on our own. You know, we are a community of human beings and we're all here and we can help one another. When you reach a state of absolute helplessness... Yeah. People will pour in to help.
Jenny, I think you've hit something there, is whether you feel worthy of accepting that help.
Exactly, and that's to do with you know, the way you're brought up. And as men, as you say, resilient, strong, got to always be standing there, never show your vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was brought up like that in my granddad was in the army and so on. But it was... But I think in situations like this, you do realise just how... actually fragile life is, you know, how
it is, everything changes.
We just take so much for granted.
Exactly.
And I know we were watching Stand Up to Cancer last night on Channel 4, and it's just some moving stories, and some of the things that we get worked up about materially.
Yeah.
And I know this is different to just like your car being broken, so this is, I'm not putting it on the same level, but the fact that we're still here, the fact that we can still enjoy life to some degree. You know, I think I've never been in your situation, so I'm not even going to try and say I know what you're going through, because I don't. All we can say is that we are here if you need us. I can lend you a fiver if you want.
Cheers,
some McDonald's
man.
Or whatever.
that would do the PR.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I think it's a lesson. I probably feel more alive than I felt. This time last week, really just because you're super challenged.
Yeah.
It's also a lesson not to look too far ahead.
Don't you think if I was to say to you a week ago what was to happen, you'd absolutely crumble, but somehow, and I know you probably have crumbled to a degree, but somehow our bodies have a way of us getting through things. I think you talked about adrenaline on the radio just
absolutely
a moment ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know when people go through shocking situations, they say something just kicks in, and I don't know, and I can't explain what it is. But
the adrenaline keeps the body moving, because it actually, you know, there's a flight or fight situation that naturally comes up, and you're holding it together in order to get through that situation. The point comes when the events have passed, the dangerous situation has passed. That's the point where your body collapses into a kind of a weakness.
Yeah.
It becomes very, very soft, and you can actually melt down
tender.
Into tears.
You're tender, aren't you?
Yeah. You allow that vulnerability that you've been protecting yourself from to actually come through, and you can end up, you know, really shaking. I mean, I've seen someone after giving birth go into the shakes from the shock of it afterwards.
Yeah.
I remember once a child had jumped into a bath I heard about of absolutely boiling hot water.
Yeah.
And I ran up there, got him out, ran him under the tap. Actually, he wasn't severely burnt, but the shock of the situation afterwards, suddenly I found myself, everything was calm, and I just literally burst into tears. You know,
I know exactly how you are. George ran out into the road one day, and it was fine. The car saw him, but your body, something takes over, you know.
Exactly.
But I've got to go, because these kids are running mine. They're banging the doors around and so on.
Another one just appeared.
Yeah, we just want to.
It's very nice. We've got a creche.
Yeah, so I just want to wish you all the best, guys.
Yeah.
And
you know where we are.
Dave,
so,
you are.
Lovely to see you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to go. I'm going to take these from McDonald's now. And if you want one, I'll be down there.
Okay, enjoy.
Yeah, and nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Lovely to meet you. Take care.
Thanks, Dave, so much.
Bye.
What I'd like to talk about is. That's Dave Hodgson and his very large family.
They live in the building.
They're going down to McDonald's, so we may join them later. Yeah. I want to talk about the idea of loss, the concept of loss, because I've met a couple of people this week who have been very sympathetic to our plight and have said to me, I've lost everything before. I know what it feels like. One was a house fire in Sussex. Another was a bomb in Beirut. But it's more the little incidental losses that have tripped me up.
They have.
Like not finding my clipboard.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, we've had the drama last night. I've been back into the office because you can still get into our house if you sort of manage to wade through the mud. And you get up to the upstairs floor. And it's like it never happened, as long as you didn't look out the window. But we've got an office still there, which is just of all the things to survive.
Yes, but
he couldn't find the hole puncher.
My hole puncher's disappeared.
Bloody hole puncher. Oh, my God, I swear.
That's no reason that should have floated away in the flood.
No, I think...
And not to have a clipboard was actually buying my new clipboard or asking for a new clipboard in a po-faced papeleria the other day was quite funny, because I said, have you got a tabla? For escribir to the woman, and she shook her head, and I said, because I've lost mine in a flood, and then she still didn't react, and I said, yeah, and I've lost two cars and 3 hectares of land, and a house is full of mud, and she went, pues para el Times es 450. Yes, that was it. She didn't even register.
Wow. Well, I mean, loss, you know, we all have our little losses in life. You know, it can be our health. It can be, you know, a family member just leaving home. It could be anything like that. And we do.
No, they're big losses, Jenny. I'm talking about annoying little losses.
Annoying little. I'm coming to that. I mean, annoying.
Like losing, you know, my favourite pair of jeans, for example.
Exactly. They're small.
Jenny, you've got those.
What? The jeans, yes, I've rinsed out the mud and they're going to the laundrette.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, darling.
Don't worry, we've found those. But yes, it can be small. To be honest, Kit, I don't have any problem with losing little tiny things, so I can't really relate to that one.
You can if you've got a piece of paper you want to file and you can't find your hole puncher.
Yes,
it's
I can.
It's not a big emotional thing. It's just one little trip up after another.
I don't get like that myself. I kind of just, you know, I think maybe... I don't know. I just don't personally find that so tricky. But I wonder whether all these little things add up to how you're living, that actually you have to have everything in order and in control. And when you don't have those things that help you function during your day, that you've got in your mind that helps you along the way, and they start to go or fall apart or you lose them, they all build up into this sort of personal crisis.
No, not so much personal crisis, just being tripped up time and time again. It's a bit like someone poking you in the ribs.
Yeah.
Bap, bap, bap. Pen, you were going to say something.
I was going to say something which was talking of small things, but the most important things. There was a meeting in the town hall in Gaussin on Wednesday, you know, help for the vecinos and all of that. Of course, that was absolutely hopeless, but there was a lovely lady there, and I'm sorry I didn't take your name, but she was dressed in a pair of pink Crocs, old tracksuit bottoms, and an orange T-shirt, and she said she'd obviously lost everything, and she was an English lady just come to live the life. And she said, and my teeth.
Oh.
Her teeth went.
Oh,
that to me would be the worst little thing.
Or a pair of glasses would be as well.
Yeah, we managed to dig those out.
But managed to dig those out of the mud yesterday, my glasses.
There's a story here, which I wonder if this would be quite strange to have done this now. Madrileños crossing the Puente de Segovia one Friday morning might well have blinked their bleary eyes when faced with the extraordinary sight of a beached sperm whale grounded on the banks of the river Manzanares. A huge sperm whale.
Now, that's a long way from the sea.
Is it?
Well, darling, Madrid is a long way from the sea.
I know it is. The Madrid-Rio area south of the city has, any new Madrid resident knows, undergone an impressive transformation in the last decade, see? Developing from little more than a rubbish clogged ditch to a haven for river wildlife, from water voles to kingfishers and surprisingly large carp. But a whale? Madrid City Hall have so far remained mysterious about the enormous cetacean, except to tantalisingly promise more information soon in a tweet. And you can find a picture of this whale, but of course, it's not a real whale. It's a replica designed with the objective of raising awareness about climate change and the global threat to whales and dolphins. It's an extraordinary picture of a beached whale in Madrid. It's just, that is, and it kind of relates to all of this stuff in a strange way.
Yeah, I think on the point going back to the small losses, I think that inside us all, there's a need to be more still in our lives. And I think sometimes when we're running, as you say, on adrenaline, and you're trying to keep going, and you've got a business to run, you've got a life to run, and you have to have everything in order, when little things start to, as you say, stab away at that, and you can't find your hole punch, or your shoes have disappeared, or a dog's walked off with something, or there's a mess downstairs in the morning, these little things can really get to us, which is why I would say, and I've had to do this in my own life, because I have lost everything. At one point, I did just have my children. It was an accumulative, long holding on to something in my life that I thought was actually going to be the answer to give me stability, my need to kind of make my future good, if you like. I was holding on to this thing that was doing the opposite, and eventually I lost it all. Now, I had to actually, it's very destabilizing, as you will know, because you've just been through this and a lot of other people have been through this disaster, to suddenly literally have the rug pulled underneath your feet, from underneath your feet, and you're standing, you feel as if you're standing on nothing. It is very, very destabilizing. And I think a lot of us fear this, have this sort of inner sense of insecurity.
But I
so
think
we have to hold
we
on.
Have, but that we have the mechanisms. Somebody who I spoke to earlier this morning has actually just had everything stolen 10 days ago. And it's obviously produced a fear. But there is no need for that in a way, because the event has happened already.
Yes, but then that's surely that's actually left an element of trauma in them, because someone has been invaded their own territory. They've been in, they've taken things. It's a personal invasion of their space.
So what to do about it? How to deal with it?
Well, I mean, support from community is obviously one of the things. Support from friends. Call people, even if it's 2-3 weeks after the event. See how they are. Make a connection. Keep connected. Don't just suddenly forget about them. You know, say they've just lost a husband or you know, a partner. Everybody knows about it. They all go to the funeral. This person has to then adjust their life.
Yes, that's the period that's worrying me, actually, when we lose our celebrity status. We're no longer that interesting.
Hi!
In about 2 weeks, you know, when it's really grim. I just want to say I just want to mention a few vecinos who turned up looking remarkably clean, actually, in the Ayuntamiento for the mayor's. The mayor was very kind and had us all in. And we had, Enrique, who was neck deep in water, hit by masonry. Our neighbour Paul, caught in a filling basement. Diego lost half his animals, trying to save the rest, torpedoed by a tree trunk. And as Penn mentioned, the old lady who lost her teeth. It's Pompey Gary on the phone. Hi, Pompey.
Yes, good morning. I've only just tuned in the past couple of minutes. My thoughts are with the pair of you. It must have been pretty devastating. I'm very sad for your troubles, etc. But a rather silly question. I've been going through a bit of a trauma the past couple of weeks anyway. Does it make you... Does episodes like this make you a better person?
Yes.
Well, ask me in a couple of months, mate. It's very early, you know. You observe, as I say, I observe that I feel much more connected, much more loved, more emotional in terms of receiving gratitude. Those things unquestionably quite what the attritional effects of what has happened to us.
You strike me as though you missed the routine of using certain items and, for want of a better word, the word routine. I mean, I've just lost, it may not seem a lot compared to you, but I've just lost my German Shepherd dog of 14 years, and I'm absolutely bereft.
Oh, man.
I'm absolutely bereft. I'm absolutely lost.
Yeah.
Of course.
How did he or she die?
Just old age. Her back end, her legs went, etc., and I had to put her down, but I'm actually, and obviously there's a guilt factor with that, but I'm walking around the house day and night just looking for her all the time. And
how long ago was that?
I just feel as though I can hear her all the time.
How long ago was that, Gary?
4 weeks ago to yesterday.
Gary, yeah. I don't know if you have any kind of belief in anything beyond the physical realm, but if you're hearing or you're feeling you're hearing that dog's bark sometimes, that actually could be a trace of your dog still being there, because I don't know how you see things. And
well, I was going to say I'm Romany on my mother's side, and we are very not the word isn't religious, but we believe in other things, etc. And we all meet up in the end.
We do, and your dog spirit is almost certainly still around you. I mean, 15
years. Can you get a better friend or companion than a dog?
Yeah, man. But also, I lost a dog July the year before last, and it broke my heart. But I got another one within a couple of months. And
a few people have mentioned that to me, but
it really does help.
I was going to say my dog, she hasn't been further than a foot away from me for the past 14 years, and it's just like waking up. Well, when I do sleep, it's like waking up in the morning and having your arms.
I think it will help you. I really do.
Time is a healer, Gary. I got to leave you because we've got
okay. All the very best
phone.
Anyway, and I wish you all the well.
Yeah. And you too. Take care.
Cheers now. Hi, Ian. Hello, Ian. Can you hear me? We've lost Ian. You're at home with the Hogs, and we're talking about trying to stay upright when your life is upside down. I want to play a song now about new beginnings, learning to love, and learning to trust again. This is by our very own daughter, Ella Chi.
I'm thinking back to that book we took the other day. I'm looking over pictures of us sitting in the park with our faces to the sun. We spent all day talking about the world and what we've done for fun. Our plans of fortune and fame.
See that click on tried to hide, is then you smile in the corners of your mouth. That flicker, I see it in your eyes. You don't even know it's there, so you forget to hide. I know it's hard for you to love again, hard for you to trust again. You won't have to look for me, I'm just a smile. It's been a mission to get to you. I remember a time it felt awkward to hold your gaze. Now naturally we fall into place. Every little movement you make, you do with grace. And if you stay, let's talk about the world and somewhere in the sun. Let's plan our fortune and fate. See that flicker you try to hide, is then you smile in the corners of your mouth. That flicker, I see it in your eyes. You don't even know it's there, so you forget to understand your
to trust someone again.
At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Big shout out to Jeff Swain, who's just Facebooked us from Portugal. Giles, he just brought in your message. Thanks, Jeff. Tales of More Floodery back in 89. But we're going to leave the flood now, because otherwise it will all become a little bit too damp and morbid. Last week, Janie spoke to us about chocolate and brought some chocolate in, and they were absolutely delicious, I have to say, Janie, those chocolates. This week, you're going to be talking about another... Well, it's more of a supplement, really, isn't it? We're going to be talking about CBD oil. Just exactly what is CBD oil?
Well, firstly, let me make something very clear. It does not taste as nice as chocolate.
Yes, it's an acquired taste, isn't it?
But interestingly, it does have some similar properties. I'll explain that in a minute. But CBD oil stands for cannabidiol, which is a... component that is found in plants, and we eat sometimes without knowing it, and also that we all have in our own bodies, that's related to our connective ability for our cells. It instructs our cells and our body and our functions to communicate with one another. It's essential in our body. When our bodies are low on cannabidols, and my terms, because I am not a scientist, are not absolutely correct, and it's quite a complex process. All of the, you know, the biology, for example.
It doesn't really matter how it works.
It doesn't really matter how it works. But I know that CBD, that you can get in plants, and that we produce some of ourselves, is the instructor. It gives instructions to the cells in our bodies to communicate and to function in the way they are meant to, at their optimum level. And as we grow older, or as we have some kind of disease or something, this element in our bodies is reduced somewhat. And as we get much older, we can almost run out of it. So even things such as, our nervous system, our digestive system, our bones, our sinews, everything, our brain function including, and this is something really, really important, connecting the synapses in the brain cells to one another.
Would that then be why that was so useful for the kids with epilepsy?
Absolutely, yes, it is. So this is actually it's like the trigger that tells a cell to say what it's meant to the next one. If you were, for example, smoking dope or marijuana, which is one of the places you can get CBD from, and is actually the one that is used. The marijuana is used. The CBD is extracted from marijuana for medical purposes and is now legal in the UK and is prescribed by doctors. It actually does have a psychoactive effect because it also has THC in it, which is tetrahydrochlorine, I think it's called, whereas CBD oil, which is extracted from the hemp plant, has a much, much, much lower level of THC in, and so won't give you a high, unless you took a whole bottle at once. Have to be quite, you know, it's
quite rich.
Rich, yes. Probably, yes. You
have to be extremely wealthy, because it's not cheap, is it?
It is not cheap. But, I mean, it's an extraordinary product. It's helped various people that I know with lumps and bumps and skin problems, even just feeling insomnia, for example. People who are losing their memory can help with memory, aches and pains, all sorts of things. Now, there's not enough research that has gone into it yet to scientifically prove everything or exactly why it works. Mm.
How long does it take to work?
It depends on the person. Some people, you know, everybody is different. We're all completely different from one another. So, I mean, you could take it for a couple of weeks and probably notice no difference at all. You could take it the first day and instantly you suddenly feel something that's kind of... It's also relaxing. And that's not to say in a drugged way. It can actually help you to feel more relaxed. Helps with the eyes as well, the eyesight.
Does it?
It does. And actually,
how clear are we that it can't do you any harm?
I can't answer that.
You mean side effects?
Yeah, like tramadol, for example.
Oh, well, it's not. This is completely natural.
Yes, so that's my point.
Taken directly from a plant. I mean, there's...
That's my point. I mean, the psychotropic ayahuasca, you can take... apparently, you cannot OD on ayahuasca.
Because it's a plant.
Because the body just offloads it.
Because
it's a plant.
The experiences for some people, though, as I believe, and I've heard of some places...
Yeah, I don't really want to go there. My point is that CBD is a plant.
It is a plant. And it's direct from the plant.
It's not a chemical.
No, but we've taken extract from the plant flower. In the case of CBD from hemp, you're actually taking it directly from the flower, which is the most potent part of the plant. And it's got the highest levels and the purest levels of the cannabidiol in it, which is cannabidiol in different forms. And, you know, if you look on the labels of these, you'd normally be able to see the chemical components, the active components. And it shouldn't do you any harm if you've got, it's providing you take one that has got a low level of THC in it, and that comes from the hemp plant.
Okay, and what is its legal status?
Here in Spain, it is legal to have CBD, providing its THC content is less than 0.2%.
Okay.
Is it 2? Yes.
Yeah.
I think so. Yes, it is 2%. 0.2%.
So where can we buy it?
Well, obviously, you know, I do have some.
You don't just go to a shop and
buy
it.
Oh, do you sell it, Jenny?
I do sell it, funnily enough.
What a coincidence.
Well, Sharon rang up last week, if you remember, and...
She did. Sharon from Mallorca. Hi,
yeah. Hi, Sharon. And she did say it was helping her. She couldn't sort of exactly say how, in a way, other than it was a kind of natural...
Jenny, do you want to, before we have to go, which we're doing in about a minute's time, do you want to just say how we can contact you?
Yes, you can contact me on 673-958-858 or email me at Jane Jewson, JaneJewson at gmail.com. Now, I have a product that's actually come in from Europe. It is a very pure, organic, and it is made actually in a laboratory, or rather it's extracted in safe conditions, and
okay.
It's all registered.
So you vouch for its integrity.
Absolutely do.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Jenny.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Our thanks to Ali Mudge, Matthew Bennett, to you, Janie Jewson, and to you for listening. It's been absolutely brilliant having your company today. A phone call. I'm sorry we haven't got time because
we have to go.
The
blackbird is
about to chirp away.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Lots of love.
See you next week.
Bye.